I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Welcome to X-Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the flaming hot desert tonight in between fires or working on your favorite project, we are about to explore where we came from, why we are here, and what we may become. Now, we might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. So recline your chair, look out the window, because we are about to launch another hour of X-Squared Radio. What a week this has been. My goodness. The solar wind is 413 kilometers per second, and the proton count is still very high at 6.0 per cubic centimeter. There are four sunspot clusters, with a fifth coming over the eastern limb today. And by all accounts, the sunspot group, they call it, I call it a cluster, AR-1515, is enormous. It stretches across almost 120,000 miles of the sun's surface, making it longer than 15 Earths set end to end. NASA solar astrophysicist C. Alex Young told Space.com today before the new flare. While today's solar flare marked the strongest of the summer season, which began in late June, just a couple of weeks ago, it's not the strongest of 2012. In March, we had one. The sun fired off an intense X5.4 class solar flare. Today's sunstorm marked the fifth X-class solar flare of the year. It was about X1.5. And there's another cluster, as I told you, headed this way. They haven't named it yet. It looks to be at least as large as 1515, which will be, by the time it gets square on, there will be five major clusters on the sun. And in the past, I'm going back to 2004 now, these individual sunspot clusters are kind of threatening, kind of like a double-barreled shotgun pointed at Earth. And even this X-class flare that blasted yesterday is going to just glance Earth. It's not a square-on blast. But the real danger, the real hazard comes when these sunspot clusters form a magnetic filament between them. It's sort of like a sideways magnetic tornado that lays down against the surface in the corona of the sun. And it connects all of these together with a giant magnetic twisting filament. And this gets very unstable. It doesn't like to resonate, and it whips around at high velocity, really, really high velocity. And what happens when these magnetic filaments snap, they kind of whip both ends out into space and launch protons. We call that a coronal mass ejection. But this cause by a magnetic filament is particularly hazardous because it is so high velocity and can carry such high volumes of protons. Now, we've had a couple of filaments this year. They did cause massive CMEs, but they were aimed away from us. So the odds of one hitting us are pretty slim, although, as I've told you several times on this program, in 1859, the Carrington event was devastating even to the low-tech 1859 telegraph system that we had in this country. Today, we are, for all intents and purposes, a digital neural network of humanity. We are connected by microelectronics in a way maybe never before in the history of the world. Maybe there have been other civilizations here on the Earth, but they may not have been as connected as we are. We are connected around the world. Literally, you can talk or communicate either through text or voice with anyone you want around the planet at very low cost. And it has done two things. It has brought us together as a species, but it's also accelerating the stratification. That is to say, the factions of humanity are, from an anthropological point of view, separating and coalescing at the same time at a very rapid rate. What would normally appear to be a homogeneous society made of all kinds of different viewpoints is now becoming a layered society made of all kinds of viewpoints, except that those viewpoints are now united. Instead of a conservative or a radical or a anti-government person sprinkled throughout society to where they really have to make a physical effort to, motor over to someone's house in order to have a meeting. They can have a meeting on the fly now, and they can share ideas, and they can get their ideas out there in an instant way across the planet. And it is having its effect, as we have seen in Egypt, and we have seen in Syria and other countries, even in, add, China, where, control of the Internet is aggressive. But, I've been in China several times, and I can tell you that your emails are monitored, but there is a way to get around it. The way the server is set up, it only monitors the emails that leave your email service and go to another service. If you email yourself, you can do so, for weeks on end with no detection. And so literally what people do is two people log into the same email account, and they simply send the email account internally email, and the other party simply reads the email and responds back to it. So the email never leaves the account, but both people are logged into the same account on different sides of the planet, and it works just fine. I have been sitting right next to people in China and in Tibet and in Nepal, all three places, that have had their emails shut down. Because they, said certain phrases in there that were that clued in the program or the person that was monitoring that email, and they decided that they were going to close off that communication. So it can be done. And the reason I bring that up is because that this heat wave that we're experiencing now in the United States is a little premature. We're just now entering in July. I mean, we had a little bit of a spring this year, and then wham, the intense heat wave has broken thousands of records from the plains to the eastern seaboard, and it'll begin to lose its grip on the weather, but not after peaking for millions today. Temperatures will soar well into the 90s, even past the hundreds, and they are all the way from Kansas to Charlotte. And even Raleigh was 108 degrees today. That's very unusual for late June, early July. Philadelphia, Baltimore, D.C. all expected to rise into the low 100s. And remember, they're just coming off of a terrible storm that snapped power lines, and so they weren't running air conditioning either. And I'm sure if you're going to an event with a suit and tie on, you definitely don't want to be in Foggy Bottom with a suit and tie. Yesterday was probably the hottest day of the summer for Philadelphia, D.C., and other cities in the Northeast. And, of course, a thermometer reading, while impressive, won't do justice to how it really truly feels, especially if you're used to air conditioning. Most Americans don't spend but about 15% of their time outdoors. The rest of the time, we're cave dwellers, air-conditioned cave dwellers, man cave dwellers, of course. The combination of the heat with intense sunshine and, of course, the high proton count and high humidity levels will yield temperatures as high as 115 in major metropolitan areas. And if you don't have a breeze, that can be unbearable. I mean, the sun actually feels painful against your skin. So there is a lot going on in the news today. I have had several people write me and ask me about last weekend at Isetti. And I got to tell you, it was a rare event. Of course, I've only been to six of them, but it was a rare event nonetheless because the crowd was almost by invitation only. Even though the doors were open, they did no marketing. And so it was a much smaller crowd by about 30%. And the people that came had a very unified intention. There was amazing synergy, great communication. There was a couple of overcast nights. Yeah, while we're sweltering out here in the east, it reached a high of 72 out there and down in the high 40s at night. So it was a bring-your-jacket weekend. Nonetheless, the people were very close and sort of like meeting with 200 old friends. So it was less like a conference than it was an event, and that's what we chose to have. That being said, it is widely known around the world that Isetti is being assaulted by the agency government. Not the agency government that we normally talk about in this program, which is located, you know, in federal corrals. This one is a local agency. Some of the members of that agency are particularly aggravated at the enlightenment that Isetti tends to bring to that area. Nobody is upset with the patrons that come there. They're all just the best people in the world. Nobody is upset with the tens of thousands of dollars each weekend that those patrons bring into the community, whether they shop at the local pancake restaurant or buy gas. And nobody is upset with the traffic because it just isn't that high, or the noise because it isn't that loud. They obey all the ordinances and all of the regulations with respect to noise and safety and et cetera, et cetera. No, there are a couple of people on this agency that don't want the process of enlightenment to continue, and so they are using the planning department to and a long and strong roll of red tape to try to wrap up Isetti to where it cannot operate. And this last Tuesday was sort of a make-or-break trial. It was not a hearing. This was an actual courtroom event where the managers, owners of Isetti, and these people at the planning department squared off. And I am told that several of the more dedicated and perhaps even qualified members or participants at Isetti had gone to the court trial. However, I've had several people write me and ask me, hey, what happened? What happened? Answer, I don't know. In fact, James ran a pre-recorded program last Saturday. The one before that was a triple-hosted program with myself and James and Mel Fabregas from Veritas Radio. And we had all of the speakers that attended the get-together, the event at Isetti, talk about and answer questions, talk about their ideas and answer questions for James's audience for a couple of hours. And it was a great time. It was a great program. It was a great on-the-air live discussion. And if you missed it, you need to go back to the BBS Radio archives and listen to it because it was excellent. That being said, you know, there was this a stress behind the scenes that you could just feel tugging on the belt loops of those that run Isetti as to whether or not they were going to survive. And I can tell you without too much punmanship that the jury's still out. I just don't know. But I will find out. Don't keep calling Isetti. Their message box is full. They're not going to answer the phone. They're just chilling. James has gone fishing, well-deserved. And the staff who, for all intents and purposes, were angelic and superhuman in their abilities to pick up the ball and make this event happen. And it's such a loving success. So thank you so much for those people that went, for those people whose intention went with it. If you feel it in your intention or in your consideration to help out eSETI, go to eSETI.org and click the donate button and send them a little bit. Maybe it'll help them out. We're interested in lots of stuff that's going on here, but the scary thing is that we have forces in this country that have not invaded us, per se, although we have been subjected to an alien invasion of astronomical proportion. It may have peaked and heading down because the opportunities in this country rival any other country in their destitution right now. But that being said, you know, different municipalities are looking for all kinds of ways to cut overhead, and one of those ways to cut overhead is to cut people, specifically police, troopers. They're reassigning them and taking them off the highways. Evidently, you've been listening to this program, and doggone it, you've been obeying the law. And those darn state troopers, those revenuers that you see out there with the blue lights, which have gone from their state-marked cars into unmarked vehicles, they haven't yet gone to foreign cars, though. They're still using American-made vehicles. But all the blue lights and all the markings and all the anything that lets you know that they're there to protect you and serve you have been carefully stripped off the outside of the car and stuffed carefully inside the car, where you can't see it unless they turn the lights on. And you can tell that they have the best intentions, of course, to stay out of sight, out of mind, and only at the last moment, like a puma waiting for that $125 payment, pounce out of nowhere, out of the ignominy of all the cars that you see on the freeway, boom. Here's an SUV or a Camaro or a Crown Vic or an Impala. It instantly morphs into a cop car like the Matrix, and you're had. You are going along innocently obeying the flow of traffic, trying to keep yourself from being run over by millions of tons of steel, and they're out there revenuing. Well, those days may be over, because at Holloman Air Force Base, at the eastern edge of New Mexico's White Sands Missile Range, 200 miles south of Albuquerque. You ever been there? No, me neither. That's because nobody goes there. It was once famous for the daredevil maneuvers of those who trained there, aircraft. In 1954, Colonel John Paul Stapp rode a rocket-propelled sled across the desert. You've probably seen the video of it, reaching 632 miles per hour in an attempt to figure out the maximum speed at which jet pilots could safely eject. He slammed on the brakes and was thrust forward with such force that he had to be hauled away on a stretcher, his eyes bleeding from burst capillaries. What a rush. 6 years later, Captain Joseph Kittinger, Jr., testing the height at which pilots could safely bail out, rode a helium-powered balloon up to 102,800 feet. He muttered, "Lord, take care of me now." Dropped for 13 minutes, 45 seconds, and broke the record for the highest parachute jump. I wonder what his thoughts were as he cut himself loose from that lawn chair tied to those balloons. Today, many of the pilots at Holloman never get off the ground. No, it's true. It's true. It's not because they've run out of money. The base has been converted into the U.S. Air Force's primary training center for drone operators, where pilots spend their days in sand-colored trailers near a runway from which their planes take off without them. Inside each trailer, a pilot flies his plane from a padded chair using a joystick and a throttle and a cold drink in his other hand, as his partner, the sensor operator, focuses on the grainy images moving across a video screen, directing missiles to their targets with a laser. Well, Holloman sits on almost 60,000 acres of desert badlands near jagged hills that are frosted with snow for several months a year, perfect training ground for these pilots. They'll fly Predators and Reapers over the similarly hostile terrain of Afghanistan. When this reporter visited the base earlier this year with a small group of reporters, he was taken into a command post where a large flat-screen television was broadcasting a video feed from a drone flying overhead. It took a few seconds to figure out exactly what they were looking at. A white SUV traveling along a highway adjacent to the base camp came into the crosshairs in the center of the screen and was tracked as it headed south along a desert road. When the SUV drove out of the picture, the drone began following another car. The reporter says, wait, you guys practicing tracking enemies by using civilian cars? One Air Force officer responded that this was the only way a training mission. It was only a training mission. We're only practicing. And then the group was quickly hustled out of the room. Though the Pentagon is increasing its fleet of drones by 30%, and don't forget that domestic leaders, not the least of which is Governor of Virginia and other municipal leaders and military leaders, have requested more than 30,000 drones to be used over the skies of America to watch American activities. Within a year or so, the number of Air Force pilots flying unmanned planes could be higher than the number who actually leave the ground. Much about how and where the U.S. government operates drones remains a secret. Even the pilots we interviewed wore black tape over their name tags. The Air Force, citing concerns for the pilots' safety, forbids them to reveal their last names. It is widely known that the United States, and I'm sure they're here to protect and to serve. By the way, you know, we often talk about Andy of Mayberry. You know that he passed away this last weekend. I had used his photograph and that of the character Barney Fife in my presentation on The Alienated Nation, which is my latest book, which, by the way, made it to number one on Amazon. I was very pleased. For several glorious hours, we were outselling every book in the genre. You can continue that trend by going to Amazon and purchasing a copy of Alienated Nation, unless you want the autographed copy and a free audio download of the entire book for about the same money by going to my website, alienatednation.com. And I was unaware that the 86-year-old was headed to the other side, but he very peacefully went, and not before he touched all of our hearts and taught a lot of dads how to raise little boys. No, I'm serious. Let me just throw in parenthetically here one of the lessons that I learned from Andy of Mayberry. Hold on while I sip my glorious grapefruit juice. Yes, I had some comments about the grapefruit juice that he said. Thank you very much for listening. I actually cut it about 30% with bottled water, so it's a little wetter than normal grapefruit juice, but I enjoy it. It wets my voice and lets me keep going. Opie Taylor had told his pa that he was going to run away. Well, Andy was Andy. I thought it was so cool. He pulled up a chair. He put one elbow on one knee and leaned over and he said, well, so you've made your mind up, huh? And Opie says, yeah, Pa, I've made my mind up. I'm going to run away. Well, I guess we better write a letter then, said Andy. Opie said, a letter? How come, Pa? Well, Andy said, well, I mean, if you're going to leave and you're not going to see Aunt B anymore, we've got to leave her a letter, right, explaining that, you know, you're through, you know, sleeping in this bed and having her good apple pie and, you know, living in this home. And you're going to strike out on your own. And, of course, we'll have to pack some provisions for you because, you know, you really don't know when your next meal's going to be. So I guess you're just going to have to pack for a while. And you know, maybe in a couple days you'll find some place to sleep and get something to eat. And Opie thought for a second. He said, "Pa?" And he said, "Yeah," as he was getting the paper and the pen. I've changed my mind. I'm not going to run away. There's no need to really write that letter." And Andy said, "Okay, I thought so. No problem. Dinner's at 5. And he got up and left. Well, you'd think, gee, that was just well written by some writer in Hollywood. But my boy, my oldest son Ben, was about the same age as Opie was in that episode. And sure enough, in a few days, he said, "Dad, I'm going to run away." Well, no dad wants to hear that. Not in real life. Not these days. But I said, well, I guess I better write a letter. And he goes, "What do you mean write a letter?" And I used almost the same words as Andy did for his actor son, Opie, on Andy of Mayberry. I just played it out, and sure enough, 1 or 2 minutes went by, and my son said, "Dad," I said, "Yeah?" "I've changed my mind. I'm not going to run away." I said, "Good for you. Dinner's at 5. It worked. This is the kind of law enforcement we used to have in this country. This is the kind of protect and to serve people that we had, neighbors living down the street, sharing our tennis club, their kids playing soccer with our kids on the local field after school. This was the law enforcement we used to have. They knew the law, they cared about the law, they tried to help people obey the law. Today, we have a paramilitary law enforcement. Today, the public is the enemy. Today, everyone walking down the sidewalk or driving down the highway is a suspect. We're going to watch them. We're going to listen to their transmissions and their phone conversations, and we're going to monitor their emails. We're going to watch their cars with robots from the sky. Just let them step out of line one time. We'll make an example of them. It is widely known that the United States has 3 different drone programs, at least if you listen to this program. The first is the publicly acknowledged program run by the Pentagon that has been operating in Iraq and Afghanistan. The other two are classified programs run separately by the CIA and the military's Joint Special Operations Command, which maintains separate lists of people targeted by the president for killing. Over the years, details have trickled out about the lethal drone operations in Pakistan, Somalia, and Yemen, and elsewhere. We've watched it on television. We've seen, you know, shoulder cams or cell phone pictures of people driving down the road, minding their own business, and boom! Their car disappears right in the middle of a busy street. Drone strike. But the drone war has been even more extensive of late. According to 3 current and former intelligence officers this reporter spoke to in 2006, a barrage of Hellfire missiles from a Predator hit a suspected military camp in the jungles of the Philippines in an attempt to kill the Indonesian terrorist Umar Patek. The strike, which was reported at the time as a Philippine military operation, missed Patek, but killed others at the camp. The increased use of drones in warfare has led the Air Force to re-engineer its training program for drone pilots. Better cameras, better crosshairs, better cross-verification. trainees are now sent to Holloman just months after they join the military. Instead of first undergoing traditional pilot training, as they did in the past, the Air Force can now produce certified Predator and Reaper pilots in less than 2 years. But the accelerated training has created its own problems. When this reporter visited Holloman in February, there had been 5 drone accidents at the base since 2009. Most of them occurred during landing, when pilots have the most difficulty judging where the plane is in relation to the runway. You know, approaching the runway at a little bit too fast of a decline. Yeah, you're already at close to stall speed, and you can't really pull up on it, and the landing gear just kind of crumples underneath the craft, and, well, the rest is junkyard history. As much as the military has tried to make drone pilots feel as if they are sitting in the cockpit, they are still flying a plane from a screen with a narrow field of vision. Yeah, it's not, they can't put every one of these pilots in a simulator with their airplane. What they need to do is, you know, get these video game players that are aces with nothing but a mouse or a controller in their hands and go ahead and put one of these joysticks in their hands and see how they fly. Then there's the fact that the movement shown on a drone's pilot video screen has over the years been seconds behind what the drone sees, a delay caused by the time it takes to bounce the signal off a satellite in space. This problem, called latency, has long bedeviled drone pilots, making it difficult to hit a moving target, sort of like playing a flight game on an old 386 computer. You remember the days. Last year, senior operatives with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula told a Yemeni reporter that if they hear an American drone overhead, they move around as much as possible. Military officials said that they have made progress in recent years in addressing the latency problem, but declined to provide details. And by the way, this detecting of the drone has become somewhat of an art. You have in this report that they hear an American drone overhead. You know, they hear the little Briggs and Stratton motor up there cranking away. The little tiny blades turn so fast that when they're approaching you, the tips actually break the speed of sound, and so they make a sound like that. They have tried different kinds of blades, you know, 5-blade props, 8-blade props, thinner blades. The only way to do it is to slow the blades down so that they don't turn quite so fast, but then you don't get so much lift and or so much propulsion, and they have to be, of course, much larger because you're turning slower. The other thing to do is to make the drones pretty much invisible. They paint them the same color as the sky. They use them at night. They fly them extremely high so that the sound cannot be heard. But out in the middle of the desert, you can hear a crow from 3 miles away. It's pretty incredible how much sound carries. The other thing is that you can't make these things invisible completely. Yeah, you can make them where radar can't pick them up. You can make them where even infrared can't pick them up. But you can't block the sunlight. So if they're operating a little Cessna, or they have a balloon sitting up where they get a nice view of the desert floor, all they got to do is look for the shadow. They see the shadow going across the desert. They know there's a drone up there, if it's silent or not. And the moving around tends to make it impossible to zero in on a target because of the sampling rate of the camera and the latency from the connection. Stationing pilots in the United States has saved the Air Force money. And pilots at Holloman who have flown drone combat missions speak glowingly about a lifestyle that allows them to fight a war without going to war. This is the ultimate in depersonalization, which is a process that every military tries to accomplish with its soldiers. No, it's true. We turn the enemy into pigs, into dogs, into subhumans. We make them numbers. pilots can fly high in the sky and drop bombs and be home for supper. They never actually see the concussion, blowing arms and legs from bodies. They don't hear the screams. They don't feel the terror. Not like a ground troop who's clearing a neighborhood, going from house to house, where enemies are hiding behind children and women and shooting from behind them. That is the kind of situation that weighs on a person's conscience forever. That is why our National Guard is dying at a greater rate of suicide than it is battle-related fatalities. Craig, an Air Force captain who is a trainer at the base, volunteered to fly Predators while in flight school. He calls the job the perfect balance of mission and family. Yeah, he gets to go home to his family. He only gets to think about digital images that are obliterated with the weapons mounted on the drones. He doesn't actually have to smell the fear. He doesn't actually have to see the terror as these drones accomplish their kill list, which is handed down to them from the highest levels. And yet, this balance comes at a cost. Pilots have flown missions over Afghanistan in the morning, stopped for lunch, fought the Iraq war in the afternoon, and then driven home in time for dinner. Lieutenant Colonel Matt Martin, formerly a trainer at Holloman, wrote about the disorienting experience of toggling among different war zones in a memoir called Predator, calling the experience enough to make a Predator pilot schizophrenic. I'm so sure, Matt. It's disorienting in other ways, too. Can a pilot who flies planes remotely ever be as heroic as the aces who flew behind enemy lines, or as Colonel Stapp, whose stunt in the New Mexico desert won him a prestigious medal for valor and put him on the cover of Time magazine? After, of course, he wiped the blood from beneath his eyes. Yes, I suppose there is valor when you face an enemy who can kill you, them or you. And sometimes you get all of them and they get a part of you. An arm, a leg, an eye, your sanity. Luther Turner III, a retired colonel who flew combat missions during the Gulf War before he switched to flying Predators in 2003, said that he doesn't view his combat experience flying drones as valorous. My understanding of the team, or the term, is that you are faced with danger. And when I'm sitting in a ground control station thousands of miles away from the battlefield, that's just not the case. But he said, I firmly believe it takes bravery to fly a UAV, unmanned aerial vehicle, partly when you're called upon to take someone's life. In some cases, you are watching it play out live and in color. As more than one pilot at Holloman told me, a bit defensively, we're not just playing video games here. True enough, Earth Explorers. True enough. I guess the goal now, since there will be more drones in the air than there are civilian aircraft, which for close to 100 years now have transported civilians peacefully from one city to another to visit grandma or to sell a piece of machinery or to sign a paper or to return to a loved one. No, now there will be robots in the sky. And they will be driven by faceless, nameless pilots thousands of miles away, out of harm's way. First generation feels it. the second generation is going to treat the list like daily duty. And the third generation, coming out of the electronic training ground of high-resolution video games and flight training games, will treat it as a competition. We'll have drone aces. I guess the trick is for us, we, you and me, to make our way through life without ever ending up on that list. Oh, that you are driving a white SUV that's similar to the white SUV that someone that's on the list is supposed to be in. Oops. Made a mistake there. Sorry about that. We're just trying to keep you safe, America. 30,000 drones over the continental United States is more than 600 drones per state. And I'm sure that they will not be allocated in an equal way. Trouble areas will have more concentration of robots in the sky. Foreign eyes, maybe at Holloman, maybe in Germany, maybe in Russia, flying a drone over our airspace looking for an enemy. Maybe your political affiliation or the way that you speak out or things that you write or positions that you take publicly against those who are trying to assert their power politically will get you on the list. If you're on one of those lonely desert nights or lonely desert roads in the middle of the night, you're the only car out there. Accidents happen, you know. You don't have to be hit by a hellfire missile. You can be hit by a rock from 10,000 feet, and it will ruin your day. Lots going on out there. I don't know if we want to put up with it. I don't really know what you can do about it. I'm not exactly sure there is anything we can do about it. Because the drone companies, the companies that are making those predators, the ones that are making those UAVs, small ones and large ones. By the way, we did have a recording here not too long ago of Charles Krauthammer, who was talking about shooting down a drone. The first person that uses a Second Amendment weapon and shoots down a drone will be a folk hero. Oh, yeah, he'll be a folk hero for about 59 minutes, and then they will hunt him down. And the video from the ground will not be too much different than what you see on the ground in Syria. He'll be standing there in a jogging suit and Nikes with his Second Amendment weapon trying to defend himself. And the lights are going to go out because that drone cost $14 million and we cannot let this happen again. I don't know if any of you watch cable television. And there are new programs coming on the air all the time, and it's difficult to get into a new one, you know, especially if you're into Lost or you're into, you know, various programs that we get loyal to and we watch season after season. But there's a new one out written by the same guys that wrote West Wing, and it's called The Newsroom. And I don't know if you caught it or not. The season opener was quite poignant. That is to say, it was stirring. McAvoy, who plays a ultra-popular walk-down-the-middle-of-the-road news personality, who is sort of come out of the days of ideology where a reporter wanted to report the news and wanted to keep people informed and decided to walk another path of popularity and entertainment. And now he's kind of torn between it, and he's been pushed to the limit. And he's at Northwestern University at an open forum with three other media magnates. And some of the alum, some of the students, are allowed to come to the microphone and ask questions. And a 20-year-old co-ed comes to the microphone, and she asks this question. I'm going to play it for you. It's about 4 minutes. We'll round out this hour with it just to let you know, in case you haven't watched it. I think it's interesting. The audio will be fine. Here we go.
Hi, my name is Jenny. I'm a sophomore, and this is for all three of you. Can you say in one sentence or less what... you know what I mean. Can you say why America is the greatest country in the world?
Diversity and opportunity.
Lewis?
Freedom and freedom. So let's keep it that way.
Well, the New York Jets.
Will McAvoy is the character.
I'm going to hold you to an answer on that. What makes America the greatest country in the world?
Well, Lewis and Sharon said it. Diversity and opportunity and freedom and freedom.
His girlfriend's in the audience. She's holding up a sign. It says, it's not. But it can
I'm not
be.
Letting you go back to the airport without answering the question.
Well, our Constitution is a masterpiece. James Madison was a genius. The Declaration of Independence is, for me, the single greatest piece of American writing. You don't look satisfied.
One's a set of laws and the other's a declaration of war. I want a human moment from you. What about the people? Why is America...
Not the greatest country in the world, Professor. That's my answer.
You're saying...
Yes.
Let's talk about...
Fine. Sharon, the NEA is a loser. Yeah, it accounts for a penny out of her paycheck, but he gets to hit you with it anytime he wants. It doesn't cost money. It costs votes. It costs airtime and column inches. You know why people don't like liberals? Because they lose. And with a straight face, you're going to tell students that America is so star-spangled awesome that we're the only ones in the world who have freedom? Canada has freedom. Japan has freedom. The UK, France, Italy, Germany, Spain, Australia, Belgium has freedom. So 207 sovereign states in the world, like 180 of them have freedom.
All right.
And yeah, you, sorority girl, just in case you accidentally wander into a voting booth one day, there's some things you should know. And one of them is there is absolutely no evidence to support the statement that we're the greatest country in the world. We're 7th in literacy, 27th in math, 22nd in science, 49th in life expectancy, 178th in infant mortality, 3rd in median household income, number 4 in labor force, and number 4 in exports. We lead the world in only 3 categories. Number of incarcerated citizens per capita, number of adults who believe angels are real, and defense spending, where we spend more than the next 26 countries combined, 25 of whom are allies. Now, none of this is the fault of a 20-year-old college student, but you nonetheless are, without a doubt, a member of the worst period, generation, period, ever, period. So when you ask what makes us the greatest country in the world, Yosemite? Sure used to be. We stood up for what was right. We fought for moral reasons. We passed laws, struck down laws for moral reasons. We waged wars on poverty, not poor people. We sacrificed. We cared about our neighbors. We put our money where our mouths were, and we never beat our chest. We built great big things, made ungodly technological advances, explored the universe, cured diseases, and we cultivated the world's greatest artists and the world's greatest economy. We reached for the stars. Acted like men. We aspired to intelligence. We didn't belittle it. It didn't make us feel inferior. We didn't identify ourselves by who we voted for in the last election, and we didn't scare so easy. We were able to be all these things and do all these things because we were informed by great men, men who were revered. First step in solving any problem is recognizing there is one. America is not the greatest country in the world anymore. Enough?
So there you have it. Will McAvoy in the episode of Newsroom, The Newsroom, telling it like it is from a, definitely a well-renowned liberal screenwriter. But what about that? In our next hour, we're going to cover a little more about that. I just want to let you know how much I care about you and care about this country, care about the time we have here on the earth with one another. We're alive here on the earth for a reason. 7 billion sentient beings all alive at the same time on one rare little blue ball floating through the cold blackness of space. There's no accident in that. Our intention and our intelligence is resonating with that of the planet itself. We can do great things. There is no limit to our imagination. There is no limit to our compassion. And as they said in Starman, we are at our best when things are at their worst. Well, I'm not saying they're at their worst, not by any means. But we have perilous times ahead of us in the next few months and maybe a couple of years. We need you. We need you to be conscious, awake, and aware. We need those around you to be conscious, awake, and aware. Because a society that is conscious, awake, and aware cannot be controlled. They cannot be ruled. And they will not be put into a set of crosshairs by a robot under the orders of one man who has a great fear. Not a fear like you would think. A fear of losing. Well, that may come and that may go, along with you and me and our children and our grandchildren. Let's see if we can resonate well enough with this planet that we can make that something the galaxy would accept. Something the universe will resonate with. Keep the blue planet alive. Good planets, as my friend Kevin Smith would say, are hard to come by. I appreciate you being a part of X Squared Radio all these years. We've been here now 6 years. This August will be our 7th year. I believe that's correct, yes. And it's been a wonderful road, I can tell you. I have no intention of ending it. When I meet you face-to-face out there at various events, and I have several coming up, you reassure me that I'm in the right place doing the right thing on Sunday evenings for 3 hours. Coming up in August, we have the Awaken Conference out in Arizona. I will post the link on the website. It is it's a small event, but it's going to be well attended anyway. After that, in October, I have two events. We have the Pythagoras Conference, of course, coming up. Lots of great speakers going to be at that. Should be kind of a bunch of fireworks, actually. Several of us there have differing views and differing approaches to how, to bring all this information to you. That one is in the Midwest, southern Indiana, actually, at a wonderful resort. Sandra Sabatini's putting it on. I'm one of the keynote speakers and individuals coming from around the world to enlighten the Midwest. You don't need a passport. You don't even need a plane ticket. It's probably within driving distance of you. Click on the blue banner at xsquaredradio.com and sign up for that very affordable, great value, $100 off, by the way, if you use that blue banner at xsquaredradio.com, and be with me. And then in November in Amsterdam from the 9th to the 11th, speaking about solar flares and new energy, and then in Chichen Itza in December from the 13th to the 22nd. If I really want you to join me on that one, we meet in Houston, and then the charter covers from Houston all the way to Chichen Itza. You'll be there with us all the way through December 21st, 2012. You might as well be at Ground Zero and have a great story to tell. And then we will return, and I promise to have you home by Christmas. We'll be back on the 22nd of December, and boy, will you have a story to tell. Be there with us. I'd love to have you there. I just think it would be a lot of fun. Let's go ahead and take a quick break. We'll be back in about 6 minutes with more X Squared Radio. Don't go away.
Myself to blame, but there's something inside that's turning my mind away. Oh, I could love you if I could let you stay.
Away. So let the Lord cry, and I can have a hearing say,
Late. That's one of my favorite songs from Queen. I just really enjoy the harmonies, and I enjoy the words of that song. It's very powerful. It's late, but it's not too late. We still have 2 hours of X Squared Radio tonight. Interesting story that I caught. I think most of you missed it because you weren't really interested in the subject matter, but the theme of the story is pretty important. It's by Emily Morris. She's a staff reporter for Breitbart. Marcia Smith vacuums a roll-your-own cigarette machine Tuesday at Smokes and Such in Skokie. For smokers who bargained on roll-your-own cigarette stores for cheap smokes, it looks like those days are numbered. Now, this is not a story about smoking. It's not a story about how great cigarettes are. I don't smoke. Most of you don't smoke. I am pretty sensitive when people smoke around me, but that's okay. It's, you know, that's not the point of the story. On Friday, this last week, the president was expected to sign into law a federal highway bill. Yeah, you know, those highway bills, they're good for construction, all those orange barrels. We just don't have enough of them out there, right? But this one had a section that redefines tobacco manufacturers to include any business with a roll-your-own cigarette machine and taxes those products at the same rate as packaged smokes. I know what you're saying. I got it. What the heck is a roll-your-own smoke machine, cigarette machine ban doing in a highway bill? Those were my thoughts exactly. You know, all these multi-billion dollar highway bills are notorious for the corruption that lurks in the small print. But this one popped out. The move comes a month after Illinois increased taxes on such roll-your-own machine-made cigarettes. Marcia Smith is 47, of Lake County. She decided after the state tax increase that she would move her Smokes and Such tobacco shops in Skokie and Gurnee to Wisconsin, where taxes on rolled cigarettes are lower. If Obama signs the law, well, it'll be federal, she said. She'll shut her doors. The machines, which cost about $33,000 each, allow customers to pick their own tobacco and pour it into a device that can roll the tobacco into a carton, or about 200 cigarettes, within minutes. Fresh, not floor-swept tobacco rolled into those white paper-filtered things that you buy in the packs that have been sitting there for months. No, 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 no. Cherry smokes. Wood. Aged smokes, pleasant smoking tobacco, with or without filters. Since 2009, roll-your-own stores have been selling cigarettes with far lower taxes than packaged cigarettes. Why? Well, in 2009, Congress more than doubled the federal excise tax on cigarettes. And to bring roll-your-own tobacco in line with packaged smokes, raised the tax on roll-your-own tobacco from $1.10 a pound. I got to clear my throat for this one because you're... I know I normally tell you you don't have to wear your seatbelt on this program, but I think just in case, you should go ahead and fasten it because you're going to need it. Here we go. Roll your own tobacco in line with packaged smokes. Raise the tax on roll your own tobacco from $1.10 a pound to $24.78 a pound. Yet, it raised the tax on pipe tobacco by a far smaller amount, from $1.10 to $2.83 a pound. And roll your own stores popped up around the country. Nothing like good old American innovation and a strong propensity for black market operations, right? I mean, if you outlaw tobacco, we're going to brew our own. I mean, if you outlaw beer, we're going to brew our own. My grandfather did. He was a proud American. Never got arrested for it. Although he used to talk about G-men coming through Kansas looking for bootleggers. Arg. Since the 2009 tax increases, Congress's Government Accountability Office, you know, you've heard the acronym GAO, right? Says roll-your-own tobacco sales have fallen 74%, while pipe tobacco sales have exploded, jumping from 3.2 million pounds to a whopping 30.5 million pounds a year, according to government reports. Yep, they were watching. The GAO concluded the increase was due to customers switching to pipe tobacco for their machine-rolled cigarettes, and not to a sudden jump in pipe smoking. No kidding. The GAO found that a carton of roll-your-own cigarettes cost half as much or even less than a carton of discount cigarettes at a store because of the lower taxes. Plus, they taste a lot better, I'm sure. State and local governments have been trying to close the loophole as well. Oh, it's a loophole now. I love it. With Cook County raising taxes on roll-your-own cigs in March and Illinois increasing the taxes on them last month, when the state sharply raised taxes on all tobacco products to help fund Medicaid, I'm sure. Oh, yeah, the funds go to Medicaid, but then they pull the funds out of Medicaid and put it into something else like a bridge to nowhere or a campaign. I got it. Starting August 1st, cigarettes made by roll-your-own machines in Illinois stores will be taxed the same amount as company manufactured cigarettes, and retail owners of the machines have to get a machine operator license. Another agency government seizure of free enterprise. It doesn't matter where the cigarettes were rolled, said Susan Hofer, spokeswoman for the Illinois Department of Revenuers. It matters that you walk out of the store with a pack of cigarettes. Well, fine, Susan. Let them walk out of the store with a pack of tobacco and a pack of rolling papers. We'll use the roll-your-own machine known as the thumb and index finger of the right and left hand with the tongue. There are 60 roll-your-own machines in the state, the department estimates. Noel Valenti, 43, of DuPage County, owns six of them. Valenti opened three Sig tobacco stores about a year ago to supplement his work as an independent construction contractor. He operated two stores in Chicago and one in Worth, but closed down one of his stores and moved two shortly before Cook County raised roll-your-own taxes. Now, the issue has followed him out to the suburbs where he lives and co-owns stores in the West Suburban Westmont in DuPage County and Mokena in Will County. They're basically making us follow the same regulations as Big Tobacco, Valenti said, but we can't reap the same rewards. Valenti calls it a killing of small businesses and said closing his stores means 21 employees lose their jobs. There you go, agency government. Way to go. Sign a highway bill, put 21 people out of work. Now that's what I call American ingenuity. He maintains that the new regulations make it incredibly difficult to continue operating the roll-your-own machines, particularly the requirement to obtain a manufacturer's license. There you go. Onerous regulations putting good old American gumption out of business. We can't have any of that now. Valenti and Smith said they offer pipe tobacco to give their customers more choices. Smith, who got into the business 2 years ago after quitting her job on a screen printing business, owns three roll-your-own machines. Doing a quick calculation, my friends, that means that Smith invested about $100,000 of her own money to go into business. And the federal government is coming down to the local Main Street in DuPage County level and shutting them down. She calls the new law un-American. Smith argues that things aren't equal for the small stores that can't compete with larger tobacco companies. It's quite clear that this is politicians and big tobacco working against small businesses, Smith said. Amen, Ms. Smith, because big tobacco has big lobbyists in Washington, and you don't. It's true the Altria-owned tobacco giant Philip Morris, USA, has been a strong backer of the federal legislation. No kidding. They are cigarette manufacturers, Dave Sutton, a Philip Morris spokesman, said, and they should make tax payments, be regulated by the FDA, and make state settlement payments just like other cigarette manufacturers. Close quote. So there you go. So it's an article on tobacco. It's an article on smoking. But it is a legal product, and we have the freedom to smoke, although it's the areas where you can actually light them if you got them are getting smaller and smaller, like your own back porch of your own home. And even then, you never know. Those drones might be watching, sniffing you out and making you snuff out that smoke. But, you know, I have to admit that the aroma of a pipe tobacco, whether it's stuffed into a pipe or in a roll-your-own cigarette, it smells a lot better than a cigarette. I don't know what the major cigarette manufacturers are putting out. I'm sure it's a uniform product, and they've done an awful lot of good for an awful lot of industries. I mean, come on. The Winston Cup used to be a mainstay of NASCAR, and now we have to use Lowe's, and we have to use Verizon and various things like that. We can't use tobacco products anymore. No, we can't advertise tobacco anymore. No billboards, no TV commercials, no Lucky Strike, not a cough in the carload. You remember those commercials, don't you? No, we can't have commercials like that. But we can sell drugs. Oh, yeah. We can put a drug on every 15 minutes on television. And then, instead of using drug salesmen to sell the drugs to doctors, we use the patients to sell the drug to the doctor. Isn't that great? Ask your doctor about Boniva. No, your bones won't break, but you'll be bleeding from every orifice in your body and your kidneys will fail. And, by the way, if you have thoughts of suicide, stop taking it right away and call your doctor. I think what they should do is slide into the highway bill a ban on drug commercials. They don't do any good. As far as I'm concerned, having patients sell drugs to doctors is about as effective as having football players work as orthopedic surgeons. Come on. All right. Let's talk a little bit about the Second Amendment. Interesting stuff going on out there. Because as I have told you on this program, the Second Amendment is near and dear to colonial America. It's been around for 375 years. That's the one reason, at least the Founding Fathers used to say, why a tyranny will never take hold of America. And any politician that tries to step on Second Amendment rights, your right to bear arms, by the way, is what I'm talking about, is going to be excoriated in the press. I mean, everyone from the NRA to the Sierra Club is going to come out and club them in the town square. But the Second Amendment has some holes in it, okay? It does talk about the firearm, but it doesn't talk about the ammunition. Now, if you want to go buy ammunition, you can do that. You can go down to Walmart and buy ammunition. I think they still sell it. You can go down to your local sporting goods store and you can buy ammunition for any weapon that you own, as long as it's not metal piercing, as long as it's not a glazer round, which is an anti-personnel round. You can buy all that stuff. It's expensive, and I don't know many people that own more than maybe a box or two. A box holds 20 rounds. And trust me, when it costs $1 a round, you don't save a whole lot of ammunition. Unless you own one of the military rounds, like 308 or 8mm or 30-06, then you can buy from bulk suppliers and, you know, it gets down to about 25 cents a round. But when you shoot all that up, one of the industries that has sprung up, another sort of like the roll-your-own-cigarette machine people we just talked about, another American ingenuity, our reloading equipment, RBG. Well, it's called the Inter-American Convention Against Illicit Manufacturing of and Trafficking in Firearms, Ammunition, Explosives, and Other Related Materials. To be sure, this imponderable title masks a really nasty piece of work. First of all, when the treaty purports to ban the, quote, illicit manufacture of firearms, what does that mean? Well, illicit manufacturing of firearms defined as assembly of firearms or ammunition without a license. Hence, reloading ammunition or putting together a lawful firearm from a kit is clearly illicit manufacturing. Modifying a firearm in any way would surely be illicit manufacturing. That is putting a scope on it, putting an extended clip on it, putting a foldable stock on it, putting laser sights on it, putting night vision on it, putting a muzzle brake on it. Any of that would be modifying a firearm. Putting a sear release in the gun that will allow semi-automatic and full automatic firing, obviously illicit manufacturing. You could buy the parts, but if you put them in, you're going to be breaking this treaty. And while it would be a stretch, assembling a firearm after cleaning it could, in any plain reading of the words, come with the screwy definition of illicit manufacturing. So you better not take that 1911A1 apart and clean it, because when you put it back together, that's called manufacturing. Firearm has a similarly questionable definition. Quote, any other weapon is a firearm, according to the treaty, and the term weapon is nowhere defined. So, is a BB gun a firearm? Probably. A toy gun? Possibly. A pistol grip or firing pin? Probably. And who knows what else? If these provisions and others become the law of the land, the Obama administration could have a heyday in enforcing them, considering some of the other provisions in the treaty. Banning reloading in Article 4 of the treaty. Countries commit to adopting necessary legislative or other measures to criminalize illicit manufacturing and trafficking in firearms, like gun shows, like selling a weapon on eBay or in the local newspaper or in the penny saver or with a little post-it note stuck down by the laundry. Remember that illicit manufacturing includes reloading and modifying or assembling a firearm in any way. This would mean that the Obama administration could promulgate regulations banning reloading on the basis of this treaty. Just as it is currently circumventing Congress to write legislation taxing greenhouse gases, it will be done with an executive order. banning gun clubs. Article 4 goes on to state that the criminalized acts should include association or conspiracy in connection with said offenses, which is arguably a term broad enough to allow, by regulation, the criminalization of the entire pro-gun organizations or gun clubs, NRA, Sierra Club, on and on and on, based on the facilities which they provide their membership. So when you go down to that local gun club and you practice your round indoors, you know, that pistol range or that 22 rifle range, that's called conspiracy in this treaty. Extraditing U.S. gun dealers. Article 5 requires each party to adopt such measures as may be necessary to establish its jurisdiction over the offenses it has established in accordance with this convention under a variety of circumstances. Now, you might think, what does that mean, extraditing U.S. gun dealers? I mean, don't we usually talk about extradition like you commit a crime in a foreign country and you're extradited to the U.S. to stand trial? Isn't that what it normally means? Exactly. You remember a little thing called Fast and Furious? Well, I guess you don't if you watch NBC or ABC. They've never played it. But if you watch the cable programs, you know all about it. Fast and Furious was a gun trafficking program that was perpetrated by alcohol, tobacco, and firearms under the auspices of the Department of Justice. The gist of it is that they packaged up thousands of high-quality weapons, semi-automatic and assault weapons, what they call assault weapons, and they allowed them to be trafficked through U.S. gun dealers to Mexico. Well, you know what the result is, right? Bad guys bought the guns, killed hundreds of Mexicans in Mexico, and ended up killing a U.S. border agent, at least one. Who knows how many others were shot at with those very same weapons. Well, they've recovered some of the weapons. But, you know, a slight oversight. They forgot to put tracking chips in the guns. They forgot to put self-destruct mechanisms in the guns. No, they're fully operational, ready-to-go, off-the-shelf weapons. And they were sold by U.S. gun dealers under this program called Fast and Furious to flow into the drug cartels in Mexico. Now, we know that Mexico is blaming U.S. gun dealers for the fact that its streets are flowing with blood. And we know it is possible for Mexico to define offenses committed in its territory in a very broad way. And we know that we have an extradition obligation under Article 19 of the proposed treaty. So, we know that Mexico could try to use the treaty to demand the extradition of American gun dealers. That's right. If a gun shows up in Mexico and it's used in a crime, under this treaty, Mexico can trace it back to the dealer who sold that gun and extradite them to Mexico to stand trial. Under Article 29, if Mexico demands the extradition of a lawful American gun dealer, the U.S. would be required to resolve the dispute through other means of peaceful settlement. Does anyone want to risk 20 years in a sweltering Mexican jail on the proposition that the Obama administration would apply this provision in a pro-gun manner? Micro-stamping. Some of you who own firearms know what this is about. It has come about of late. It is not visible with the naked eye. Article 6 of the treaty requires appropriate markings on firearms. And it's not inconceivable that this provision could be used to require micro-stamping of firearms and or ammunition, like the casing or the slug, a requirement which is clearly intended to impose specifications which are not technologically possible or which are possibly only at a prohibitively expensive cost. For instance, I don't know how many rounds, unfired rounds, are out there on the market right now, but under this treaty, all existing ammunition could be outlawed, which means all those rounds you have in your gun cabinet would then be contraband. You would have to turn them in And if you signed that little yellow paper down at the gun store or the gun show when you bought that ammunition and you can't account for it all, they can come to your house and search it. Once all that illicit ammunition is collected, you will be required to buy micro-stamped ammunition, which I'm sure will be rare. Let's see what our listeners have to say about this. John from Vancouver, welcome to the program. Nice to hear your voice.
Hey, Brooks, how are you?
I'm doing fine. By the way, did you hear anything about E-SETI? How did they do in court?
No, I haven't, no.
Okay, I was just asking. I thought maybe some people hung around after Monday to see what went on. What's on your mind? Are you listening tonight? This is quite the topic, isn't it?
Well, I have, on and off. I'm actually cooking dinner, so it's on and off. What I want to talk about is the Inner Earth expedition. But what I will say is, my dad was a hunter, and he did his own ammunition. So he would save his shells. He usually used a .222, so he'd save the shells, buy the gunpowder and a little cap on the back. And he had a little device to mount the cap into the shell, and that was it. He'd have a new bullet, and that was pretty cheap. So I reckon it wouldn't be too hard to, provide the different chemicals for gunpowder and a little way of manufacturing the cap on the back.
Well, I suppose you could.
Spread that around.
You realize that if you attempt to do that, then you're going to be illegally dealing in firearms, and you could be considered a terrorist under this treaty.
Yeah. Well, let's go for it. are we going to sit around and put up with this crap?
Well, we don't really have a choice. Congress doesn't get a say in this because this is going to be an executive order. Treaties are signed by the president.
Well, okay, I actually don't want to talk about this, but, if it's going to be aggressive from Washington, then it has to be aggressive from the common person. Because we're going to just sit around and get rounded up? Like what the heck?
Yep. I'm with you. Okay, let's change the subject.
This is really aggressive action here.
I know. And, what can you do? Once it's law, people will just sit back and say, yeah, but they won't do anything about it. Just like the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, where the federal troops can detain you without Miranda and without habeas corpus and export you from the country, no trial and no charges filed.
Okay, well, we'll keep an eye on this one, and all I can say is I actually don't own a firearm, but I am thinking about buying a bow and arrow because I don't have to jump through the hoops.
Yep, I'm exactly the same. I'm moving to Vancouver, that's for sure. Okay, let's talk about what you want to talk about, the expedition.
Yeah, okay. I'll just start off by saying I'm an artist, and if you need an artist like myself, I'd be more than happy to be on board. The next thing I would say is, when you're talking about Inner Earth, it's sort of in the same category or neighborhood as something like, say, Shangri-La, that kind of mythological thing.
Well, a true scientist would gather all the data from all sources and myths and history and, traditions that are held over hundreds of years, as far as I'm concerned, are valid data. So, yeah, we consider all of that.
Yeah. Well, how am I going to approach this one? I just heard a private interview with someone who talked about when they were, a child. They had two friends. Their parents said, you were talking with two friends. And finally, the parents said, there's no such thing as two friends. So eventually, after hearing that, he didn't see them anymore. And so when it comes to something like Inner Earth or Shangri-La or that kind of thing, I think we're dealing with something really similar. And that is removing the, the barrier, I suppose, to being able to actually perceive something like Inner Earth. I think it's similar to something like a... Go ahead.
Well, yeah, you bring up a really good point, and that's one of the reasons why all of the leadership staff has been through advanced training in that very kind of thing.
Yeah, I read that, yeah.
And as soon as the ship, you know, leaves the port there in Murmansk, we're going to begin almost 24 hours a day in shifts training for all of the scientists that come with us. So... You know, they're going to have to go through that kind of training to try to raise, let's just call it the consciousness or the vibrational level of the entire ship, because we got to meet the conditions of whatever the experiment calls for. We can't go up there with a dark, doubting mind and expect this, you know, ancient mythical appearance to manifest itself.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess all I was trying to say is that it's kind of like a childhood perceptual thing. Like if you can get highly trained scientists to go back to their childhood and remember what they may have perceived that would be out of the ordinary, then I would say you got a much better chance of actually perceiving Inner Earth, which I reckon exists. Already.
Well, in that case,
along with Shangri-La and other mythical type places.
In that case, I think we need an artist to come with us.
Well, you know, I'm available.
Have you applied?
Pardon me?
Have you applied? Have you filled out the form at the website? I'm sure you have.
I haven't. No, it just sounded like it was for scientists and that kind of thing.
No. Well, yes, scientists, but also, you know, professionals with other skills. There are 38 discretionary.
Oh, well, okay. I'll apply. And
you should apply. Go to.
I know within politics it can get pretty dense and that kind of thing. But the fact that you've put together this journey, this seeking, to me is really uplifting, and it's a real highlight, and I'm sure something will come out of it. Don't know what, but it's just such an accomplishment. I admire you so much for putting it together, and it's very exciting and uplifting.
That's the spirit. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I appreciate the call. I get up every day when I think about comments like that. I appreciate it.
Okay, that's really why I wanted to call in, and you know, I'd like to see a little more focus on that, on just a little bit every week as to how it's going, and I'll certainly look at the forms to fill out because that would be really just fantastic to kind of be there and.
Let's go to NPIEE.org, N-P-I-E-E, which is short for North Pole Inner Earth Expedition.org, and go to the contact tab, and there's just fill that out, and you know you could be voluminous with your text.
Okay. There's no limit. Okay. And, so, now, as far as weapons go, I grew up, you know, shooting guns. My dad taught me, and he, you know, did his own bullets and that kind of thing. And actually, my dad was a German, and his buddies, they were foresters. When the German laws against guns came through, he and his buddies were faced with trying to hide them, and he hit his, several of his buddies were caught, a number of them disappeared, and one came back because the family had money. So, from experience from Nazi Germany is that when there's a pressure on getting rid of guns, that preceded a fascist type of government. So that's from direct historical experience from my father.
Well, hopefully we learn from history.
But I didn't hear that.
I said, hopefully we learn from history.
Well, that's right. So when people are getting passive about it, it's no time to be passive. Not that you want to use the gun. You just want the freedom for it to be in your possession, and if you so choose to use it, that's your freedom. Hopefully you don't want it, you know, ever have to use it. But to have it taken away, well, that's the beginning of fascism right there.
Yep. Well, fortunately, there are more guns than there are people in this country right now, but I don't know about
Yeah, well, that's actually kind of heartwarming.
Exactly. All right. Hey, John, thanks for the call.
I just love that. I just love to hear that.
All right. We'll talk about it a little more in the last hour.
Okay. Bye for now.
All right. Thanks. Good night. All right. Let's see. Let's go to Rollin in Los Angeles. Welcome to the program. How are you, sir?
Good, Brooks. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Good to hear your voice.
I have a quick question. How are you doing on those regulations with the turning things back and the national magazine you contacted and all that? Anything response?
Refresh my memory, because
I'm regulations that have been passed against businesses since December of 2007.
Oh, the Control Alt Delete Act. Yeah, actually,
right.
We've put it out there, and interestingly enough, I called the senator from one of the states that I know, Rand Paul. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you know him.
Right.
I told his office about the Control-Alt-Delete Act, and I don't know how it made it through the grapevine that quickly, but the next day, Mitt Romney said that he was going to repeal all, quote, Obama-era regulations. That would be
really?
December
31st,
2007. So it's out there, and he's still saying it. So it looks like it's got some legs.
Well, I called a senator here in California's office, and also a congressman that's my congressman in the area. And they said to send them an email. The problem with sending them emails is they get thousands of emails. So I think it might be best if I fax to them. Because I think they attend to the faxes before the emails.
Yeah, I can do that. They also have their website, and you can send them notes through that, and they do respond. The best way to get through is to go to your local office, your constituent office for him, not the Washington one, and call them, because there are humans that answer the phone there, and they have to log that they got a call. And let me tell you something, a phone call is worth a lot in Washington, especially from a constituent.
So you think your local office, rather than going to the Washington office, is a better choice?
Oh, yes, absolutely, because the local office ties to that official's reelection. The one in Washington, nobody cares.
Okay, because I did make those phone calls. I did discuss the matters with them, and I know they probably logged it.
Well, that's good. That's exactly what you should do. That is great. If I could get everybody who has read the book to do that, we could change the course of history in this country.
Well, I'm looking at another thing. Here in California, we have some local California issues. I called the governor's office, and I spoke with one of his employees. The situation out here is they want, well, it's already been signed. They're going to ask for more taxes, sales tax and that in November on the ballot. If the constituents in the state do not vote for the tax increase, person was telling me that the school systems will suffer greatly more, and on top of that, the university systems in the state will have to charge a higher tuition. And that's not going to work because people can't hardly afford it now.
I know. Well, I know what you're saying. I have a son who's a senior in college right now, and the cost is unbelievable. I mean, I graduated college. I had about $39,000 in school loans. It took me about 10 years to pay them off, but I paid them off. And right. I don't know if you can get it done for that now.
No, and on top of that, when these people graduate, they have no jobs. They'll pay them for the things they've been taught, to, you know, the education they have. So on top of that, they can't get the higher-paying jobs that will pay those loans back. So the loan market here in California for students has collapsed. I mean, the students can't pay the loans back. So everybody now is looking for other alternatives in order to go to school, you know, whether it be family money, whether it be grants, you know, some other means, because the student loan market is very difficult.
Well, it is, and actually the federal underwriting of those loans has become questionable as well. Just because they're being federally underwritten doesn't mean the banks are going to do it. Fortunately, all the presidents for the last, 16 years have approved on an almost annual basis this low interest rate for student loans. But it's getting ready to expire. Right. It's getting ready to expire. And I don't know if Congress won't hold it over the head of Obama and let it go up.
Wow. If they do that, these students are in big trouble. They're not going to be able to get those loans.
They won't give them. I mean, they'll have to raise their own money to go to college. And I'm not so sure that institutional education is going to stay what it is today. So much information, by the time it gets to the university level and comes out the mouth of a professor, is obsolete. I think that you can get world-class, leading-edge information directly off the net, and there are lots of online colleges. I went to one for one of my master's degrees, and it was great. It was hard. Very few people actually finished, but it was good. I got the information, I took my national exam, and I passed.
See, the thing is, I was told by somebody a long time ago, I heard those colleges are great too, but the thing is, those cost money also. So you have to somehow be able to afford to pay for that.
Well, that's true. That's true.
But value make those loans available.
Yeah, I agree with you. There is definitely a cost to be borne, but it is value added. You know, education isn't free unless you just want to apply yourself, in which case you're going to have an uncertified education, but you're going to be smart as hell.
Right. But that means you don't have a piece of paper in the certification in order to go into a workplace in an environment and say, I have a degree.
Yep. You bring up a good point. It is a quandary, and if they start closing off all the avenues to educate the people, then the people become stupid, and you end up paying the price for it. If it wasn't for foreign visas right now, this country would be up a creek. Foreign students coming in paying three times the tuition that a normal state resident would pay. And they're the best of the best when they come in. They're walking out with PhDs. When I got my degree in nuclear chemistry from Tennessee Tech, I was probably the only Caucasian in the entire congregation. All Chinese and Indian.
I wouldn't doubt it at all.
And the only PhD granted that summer was to a Japanese woman in civil engineering.
Those are tough educations to gain today, and the problem is they're expensive because the price has gone up on everything. Even online colleges, everything has gone up.
I know. Inflation is hitting us at the retail side, but wages have dropped. The availability of jobs dropped. Something like 40% of people are not working in their chosen careers. They're working in a compromised position. Yeah, exactly. Whatever you can get. At least one job.
You brought up a good point. This is something that really bothers me. When I talk to people and they say, at least I have a job. Okay, and they're working for like almost minimum wage. And I'm sitting there going, wait a minute, you're complacent with at least you have a job. Well, it's better than not having a job. Well, do you see anything in your future of a game to where you can go up the ladder and actually get a better paying job at some point? No, I'm just happy to have my job. The people are becoming complacent.
That's right, because people are not living to work. They're working to live.
Right. There's a big difference. Big difference. And one last little point here in California. This one's great. I discussed this with the governor's office, but also my state assembly. There was an assembly bill that was also passed recently, or not passed. It's about the water projects here in California. What they're going to do is they're going to tax all these towns and areas that are on the water projects, not in Los Angeles, that's the Department of Water and Power. The major cities have their own water source. But the ones that are getting it from aqueduct systems and that within the state, they want to levy a higher tax. Here's the thing. They even want to tax well water being pumped out of the ground in these areas.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And here's the deal. I talked to them. I said, you know, I'm going to tell you something. The people I know in this one particular area called Rosemont, this area, the people can hardly make ends meet. Now they're going to tax their well water. I mean, you know, how much pressure are they putting on people, you know? People have to have water, and we've been in extreme drought here in California.
So they're going to make you put a smart meter on your well pump, and then they're going to bill you those taxes for the amount of gallons you pump out of the ground.
I have no idea what their plans are, but I'm sure it's something similar to that. It's incredible, you know? I mean, these poor people there, they got no way to hardly eat. And now they have to pay for tax on their well water. Gee, so much. And people are getting discouraged. You know, not everyone. Some people have a lot of money and they're doing quite fine. Other people have good paying jobs. They're doing quite fine. But the other end of the spectrum, they're becoming to where they just don't care anymore. And that's scary because we have a lot of those. Like they feel they have no hope.
Yep.
Happens, going to happen, and they don't care. And I actually have people say that to me. I don't care what happens. I don't even care if I vote. Oh, my God. You know, you're never going to get anything changed that way.
They act like it doesn't make a difference. I agree with you.
Anyway, I just wanted to hear what happened on the regulation thing, and I will continue to try to contact the offices locally here about that. I think if they don't spark business alive here in California more than it is, we're in trouble in this state. And I think the nation as a whole.
I couldn't agree with you more. I appreciate the call, Colin. We'll keep you posted.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, interesting. Interesting feelings out there, almost desperation. You know, we're talking to Vancouver, we're talking to California, and we're hearing the same thing. It's like people are feeling that it doesn't matter if they vote, it doesn't matter if they work hard, they're never going to get ahead. And every time it seems like they get a little bit of money in the bank, the government comes up with a new way. And you got to remember, this is the agency government we're talking about. We're not talking about the elected officials. I can tell you from personal experience that the freshman congressman, Democrat and Republican, even the ones that have two or three terms under their belts, they're good guys. They work hard. They care about you. They were elected fair and square, and they're in Washington trying to make a difference. The leadership, however, the ones that have been there for 20, 25, 30 years, that's quite a different story. It is an organization that's very tough to crack. And even if you do get on the committees, you may or may not be allowed to speak. You know, may or may not be allowed to enact or present legislation. The main thing to pay attention to here is that there are two governments. There's the one that you elect on your local level, the one that you may or may not get to hear a speech. I can tell you that if they're an incumbent, you're probably not going to get to hear them speak much, because they're able to use the power of their office and the bully pulpit to get much more publicity than what the person that's running against him, the challenger, might be able to get. So it takes a tremendous amount of, if not money, organization and creativity to get your name out there so people know who you are and will vote for you and toss the incumbent out. That happens every 2 years. But obviously, if you got a person that's running for 8, 10, 12, 15 terms, they're not running against, you know, very challenging incumbents, or they have a system that just cannot be broken. And they're able to operate these dynasties with huge amounts of money and control with lobbyists and special interests. There are two different Washingtons working. One is driven on the what we call the bureaucratic side, or the bureaucracies. I call them the agency government. And the other one is the elected government, the one that you think you're affecting when you go to the polling station. And we need to bring those two together. We need to put the control of government back in the hands of the people, which the government is supposed to serve at our leisure, at our pleasure. We allow them to govern us. At no time ever, anyone that I speak to or anyone that I've ever read, do we allow them to rule us. But that appears to be what's going on. And the despair that I'm hearing from the callers and from emails and texting that I get from various people around the country, I feel the same thing. I hear the same thing. So we're talking about this treaty that President Obama has the authority to sign. And this is not a rider on the transportation bill, like the roll-your-own cigarette ban, or not ban, but taxation and manufacturing licensing requirements that are obviously going to put those people out of business. This is a treaty, which the president has the right to sign treaties. And this would allow the extradition of legitimate U.S. gun dealers who sell a legitimate weapon to an authorized, cleared person, because they have to go through a five-day background check and all that stuff to even be able to buy a weapon. If that weapon ends up in Mexico and it commits a crime, or it's found in a criminal location and it's traced back to that U.S. gun dealer, they're going to be able to extradite that gun dealer to Mexico. So this is driven specifically, and I got to tell you, I'm not much of a conspiracy theorist, but sometimes, doggone it, it just makes sense. Why in the world would they perpetrate an operation like Fast and Furious? Why let thousands of high-quality, brand-new weapons make their way to Mexican drug cartels in Mexico? I mean, what was the theory behind that? Oh, we'll give them guns and let them kill each other off, and then we won't have the problem. We'll have one big turf winner to worry about instead of a whole bunch of little ones. Or was the idea that, you know, we'll be able to trace these guns because they have a serial number on them, and we know where they went, and we'll follow them back through the networks, and we'll close down the ability to traffic these guns into Mexico? Or was it to create a false flag event where tougher gun regulations would come about? I mean, nobody expected the guns to be turned on a U.S. border agent. Really? I'm sure nobody expected that, right? They only expected a few hundred Mexicans to be killed with the guns. And then they would turn around and pass this treaty, which would allow shutting down legitimate gun dealers. And we talked about this requirement for micro-stamping. By the way, micro-stamping is done with a laser. Every single round, the brass and the slug, if you buy commercial slugs for reloading, they will be micro-stamped at great expense. Because, you know, these machines that you know, crank out copper-coated lead for either ball ammunition or a hollow point ammunition, you know, they do it by the gazillions. So it's low cost. You can buy a slug and you can buy a 3 or 4 cent primer, and you can take your brass, trim it, resize it, and reload it, and you can have, you know, 20, 30 cents in a round that cost you $1.20. And there's a great amount of savings. Shotgun shells can be reloaded, 45 ACP rounds. You're looking at less than a nickel a round. So it's economic rather than go to the store and buy rounds for your 45 caliber or your 9mm. Just reload. And 223s are the simplest things in the world to reload. You don't even have to measure the powder. They're designed that way. The shell can actually be topped off with a 4120 gun cordite right to the level top, and then you simply crush the slug into the top. It can be done with a pocket reloader. But according to this treaty, that is illicit manufacturing. And if that micro-stamped slug or that casing, micro-stamped casing, ends up being found at a scene of a crime, either on the ground, you know, if a murder takes place in the woods and you went hunting there a couple years ago and your brass is laying there on the ground, they're going to come find you. Not to mention, there's a prohibitive cost that goes to it. So you won't be able to buy those or even find those rounds. They'll be the official government round. Now, the last one, and this is the one that's everybody knows about, everybody talks about. Every time you go buy a gun or sell a gun or go to a gun show and look at a gun, you hear about this, and that's gun registration. Every gun that's less than 100 years old has to be registered by serial number and your name in the United States. So if you sell that gun, you better make sure that that yellow form is filled out and that that serial number is transferred to that new owner, because that serial number will follow you for life if you don't. And if ever, in the next 20 or 30 years, if it's used in a crime, they're going to trace it back to you. So gun registration is a big deal. Article 11 in this treaty requires the maintenance of any records for a reasonable time that the government determines to be necessary to trace firearms. This provision would almost certainly repeal portions of the McClure-Volkmer and would arguably be used to require a national registry or database. Right now that is done by state. And it's only been since 9/11 that those gun registration databases have been tied together on a national database, but it's still state by state. There's no national registry. Now, one of the reasons I never joined the NRA when I was a gun enthusiast, which I am no longer, was because the mailing list for the NRA is a who's who of Second Amendment proponents. So I felt like being a card-carrying member of the NRA made me a prime suspect. I never wanted to be. So I decided to never join. I do not own a pistol at all. I own one very old World War I rifle, and that's it. And it hasn't been fired in years and years and years. It's just there because maybe it's home protection, let's call it. Do I know how to use one? Yes. Do most people know how to use one? It doesn't take much practice to get good at it. The point is that there are more guns than there are people here in this country, and anybody that wants to take over this country has to take that into consideration, including our own government. But piece by piece, what the authority of figures are allowed to have and what the public are allowed to have are two separate things. That's completely separating the weapons. You obviously cannot own a fully automatic weapon. You can't own a grenade launcher or a bazooka or a cannon or anything like that. That would give you, you know, an even arming footing as perhaps National Guard troops, we always wondered. They would be called up to go house to house and collect all the firearms. Hey, it's been done in countries almost as large as ours. So don't think that it's outlandish. Now, that being said, Second Amendment is near and dear, going all the way back, as I said, 375 years to colonial days. So it would be tough to do. And you most assuredly would serve one term if you run fast. But blocking the ammunition, that's a little more nefarious. A gun makes maybe an effective club, but not very good one, not without ammunition. But you can ban the ammunition or you can regulate the ammunition to the point where it becomes prohibitively expensive. Let's take a quick break, about 5 minutes. We'll listen to a little Muse with Uprising, and we'll be right back after this. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming your way. Radio coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our accurate forecast. It's still about 100 degrees outside. It has been brutally hot this week, just brutal. Next week, actually tomorrow, is supposed to start cooling off, and maybe we'll be able to survive. I saw two birds take off from a power line today and just burst into flames when they hit the air. So it's definitely hot out there. If you don't have air conditioning or if you're in one of those power beleaguered areas of the country, take it easy. Make sure to drink plenty of fluids. Listen to webcast radio on your device. Lots of ways to listen to X Squared Radio. You can listen at bbsradio.com or you can click on the app, the Android app at xsquaredradio.com and get it right on your phone. And you can listen to the program live that way. Or you can listen to the archives at either bbsradio.com or xsquaredradio.com. Please sign up for both. There's a link at X Squared Radio. Just sign up for the BBS Radio archives. We encourage you to use that. Lots and lots of great hosts. I was on Patricia Corey's program Saturday. Had a wonderful time. She's a great interviewer, definitely a world explorer, and I recommend her program. Saturday mornings at, I guess that would be 2 p.m. Eastern time. Really enjoyed myself. Good program. Also, I was able to meet with Neil Kramer this last weekend in Washington, and he's got a new book called Unfoldment that I highly recommend. Please go to Amazon and buy that book. He's going to be on the program on the 29th. You can have it read and be ready for the interview and be able to intelligently contribute to the program. Neil Kramer is an excellent, excellent researcher, great speaker, and he's been all over crop circles and human consciousness experiments, and very, very qualified to talk about these subjects, and really enjoyed meeting with him and sharing a campfire a couple of nights out there with the crowd. So great guy, Neil Kramer. The book is Unfoldment, Unfoldment. Don't forget that we've got three conferences coming up pretty quick. One in October, the Pythagoras Conference. Click on the blue banner at X Squared Radio. You get $100 off. It's in southern Indiana, so you can drive to it. It's affordable. You're going to get 50 speakers from around the world, and you can take a lot home from that. If you have a passport and you're ready to travel, you're ready to explore the wonders of Chichen Itza, you can go with us to with Power Places, Greg Braden, myself, Marine St. Germain, others speaking down there at that venue, and you can be at Ground Zero December 21st, 2012, where it all began, where the Maya calendar was originally carved and invented. So you'll have a great story to tell when you get back. We're going from the 13th to the 22nd of December. I promise to have you home by Christmas. That will be one for a lifetime. It only comes once. Click on the orange banner, Maya 2012 at X Squared Radio, and sign up today. In our last hour, we talked a little bit about this this Second Amendment treaty that is going to be, looks like it's going to be signed by the president. We also talked about a highway bill that targeted roll-your-own cigarette machines, and has basically taken the roll-your-own machine rolled cigarettes and taken them off the market because these, budding, innovative, entrepreneurial manufacturers are being subjected to the same rules that the major tobacco manufacturers are being applied to, and they're not going to survive. So you're either doomed to buying pipe tobacco and rolling papers, and hopefully you never get pulled over with that stuff. So probably go through your car and you're going to miss your appointment or be late to work. And you're going to get kind of a funny look when you take out that lavender rolled cigarette and smoke it in the company smoking grounds too. So just to let you know, they're just making it hard on you all the way around. I can't imagine that people that roll their own cigarettes would be a nice tax target for the federal government. I think they're more competitors against big tobacco, but that's just my opinion. Now, I call this section the tax that never was. And, people ask me sometimes, well, who are you voting for? And the answer is, I don't really know. I mean, I like Ron Paul, but you got to vote for a winner, right? So I'm thinking Mitt Romney, but every time I mention that name, I'm just, people in this genre just beat me up. They don't trust him. I just got to tell you, I dislike him less, okay? Well, thanks to some unforced errors committed by Team Romney last week regarding the Obamacare tax penalty issue, the corrupt media was able to keep the focus of the presidential election exactly where Obama wants it kept, off his failed record and on Mitt Romney. The media never, however, will expose the White House's own hypocrisy on this issue, including its own Solicitor General making the tax case for Obamacare before the Supreme Court. You know, I listened to the arguments a little bit. I read the articles on it. I never heard the word tax being used. Did you? Did you know it was going to be a tax? Did you know the middle class were going to have to cover this bill? Well, something the media won't be able to spin, though, is that even though Obamacare is a job killer in the private sector, it's a boon for federal employees who enjoy the kind of health and pension benefits you and I can only dream of. Specifically, IRS agents. Yeah, that's right. How many exactly? Can I see a show of hands for 2,000? Oh, no hands. 10,000. Okay, a few more. Would you believe 16,500 new IRS agents? If it's not a tax, what the heck do you need 16,500 new IRS agents? The IRS says it is well on its way to gearing up for the new law, but has offered little information about its long-term budget and staffing needs, generating complaints from Republican lawmakers and concern from government watchdogs. The IRS is expected to spend, I would just tighten that seatbelt up just a little bit from the gun control, okay? Just not where it's really cinching in there, but you definitely want to be held in your seat for this one. The IRS is expected to spend $881 million on the law from 2010 through 2013, hiring more than 2,700 new workers and upgrading its computer systems. But the IRS has not made public information about its spending plans in the following years when the bulk of the health care law takes effect. The lack of information makes it impossible to determine whether the IRS bill will have adequate workers to enforce the health care law. And I just don't understand that sentence at all. I would just love for you to call me and help me understand that sentence. I'm confused. Are we talking about IRS taxes or are we talking about health care? I just see them here in the same sentence and I'm not getting it. The lack of information makes it impossible to determine whether the IRS, I'm sorry, does the IRS have doctors working for them? Will have adequate workers to enforce the health care law. The Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration said in a report 3 weeks ago. The report, however, concluded that appropriate plans had been developed to implement tax-related provisions of the law. In 2010, House Ways and Means Committee Republicans issued a report saying the IRS may need as many as 16,500 additional auditors, agents, and other employees to investigate and collect billions in new taxes from Americans. That assessment has been widely cited by opponents of the law. The IRS disputes the jobs number, but, of course, they haven't offered another one. Well, it's good to know Obamacare is creating jobs somewhere. Remember this information and spread the word. Yes, as I said, the media cannot spin this story, but that means they're going to memory hole it. You know what a memory hole is, right? Like, where did I leave my keys? Just like they're memory holing the fact that 75% of the Obamacare burden will fall on the already drowning middle class. After all, Americans need to know about Ann Romney's horses and Mitt's jet ski and Seamus and to be told more lies about Bain's outsourcing and. Okay, that's all we're going to cover on that story. We don't normally do politics here, and that was absolutely pure politics, but it is going to reach deep into the pockets of every single small business that listens to this program, including mine, by the way. I was speaking with a small business owner just the other day who lays hardwood flooring. Excellent work. Tremendous worker. And super high quality stuff. And you know what he's worried about? Not the price of laminate. Nope. He's not worrying about the price of gas. Uh-uh. He's worrying about the price of health care. That's what's going to put him out of business. He's been doing it his whole life. He has a great crew, high-quality workmanship, and he's going to be put out of business by this health care law because nobody is going to buy his flooring at the new price. It will drive the, it will probably double the price of his flooring, because that comes right out of profit. It's unbelievable. The gist of it is this: if you are healthy, and most 85% of the nation is most of their life healthy, they can usually afford their own health care. They get sick, they go to a doc in a box, they pay a couple dollars, they get treated, they get a drug, whatever, they get a sore throat, stitches, a bone set, whatever it is, and they go home. It doesn't break them. It's not financially overwhelming. And for 85 to 90% of Americans, that's exactly the same story. You know, you might have a gallbladder removed, you might have, you know, a bone set or stitches here or strep throat or whatever, a bladder infection, blah, blah, blah. All that stuff gets taken care of with a few hundred bucks, you're done, you're out the door, you paid it off, and you go your merry way. Unfortunately, 9 to 15% of the society has been spinning the revolving door of the emergency room off its axle. And they go in and they get service at these hospitals and then they walk out without paying. And in what happens is communities and tax burdens, hospitals, end up paying that themselves. Well, evidently that's become such a burden. Two things have happened. One, hospitals have eliminated their public emergency rooms. The hospitals are specialty clinics now. They're heart hospitals or they're bone specialist hospitals or they're bone marrow transplant hospitals or oncological hospitals, but they don't have emergency rooms. So in true American entrepreneurial spirit, physician's assistants, which for all intents and purposes are doctors, they work under the auspices of a physician, are running walk-in clinics. You don't need an appointment. You don't need insurance. You can walk in for $100. You can get pretty much any treatment that you need, get a prescription, walk out, and you're well. And you go on your way. It has replaced the emergency room for about 90% of all the sniffles and coughs and stitches and everything that are needed on a public basis. So, and they're doing well, by and large. They're all around the country, these urgent care places. Just look around. They're there. Now, you'd think that would be enough of a solution, but evidently it's not. So the government is trying to force everybody into a single national insurance pool. Their thought is that it will bring costs down, but actually the glut of cash will cause the cost of healthcare to explode. And what it will do for people that are healthy is it will force them into a system taking money out of their disposable income, which they would normally use to buy a car or clothes for their kids that are going to school or furniture or a new lawn, or buy a home. It takes that money and gives it to the government. Of course, I'm sure they know what to do with it better than you do anyway. So that's all I got to say about that. I'm sure you're as happy about it as I am. One of the ways that entrepreneurs make their way in our country is they look up. That's true. This section is called Now Boarding for the Moon. Space tourists may soon be able to pay their own way to the moon aboard old Russian spacecraft retrofitted by a company based in the British Isles. The space flight firm Excalibur Almaz estimates that it can sell about 30 seats between 2015 and 2025 for $150 million each aboard moonbound missions on a Salyut-class space station driven by electric Hall effect thrusters. Didn't know that stuff existed, did you? Excalibur Almaz, founded by Chief Executive Officer Art Dula, estimates it will take 24 to 30 months to develop the remaining technology needed and to refurbish the ex-Soviet spacecraft and space stations the company already owns. It bought four 1970s-era Soviet Almaz program three crew capsules. It looks a little bit like a triangular washing machine. And two Russian Salyut-class 63,800-pound space station pressure vessels. Declaring that he is ready to sell tickets and that a 50% return on investment could be achieved in 3 years, Dula told the Royal Aeronautical Society's third European Space Tourism Conference on June 19th at $100 million to $150 million per seat we can sell, up to 29 seats in the next 10 years, and that is a conservative estimate. He says, we chose not to, for this presentation, the aggressive estimates to present. Those conservative and aggressive estimates are from a market study entitled Market Analysis of Commercial Human Orbital and Circumlunar Spaceflight, carried out for Excalibur Almaz by the management consultancy Futron. In 2009, Excalibur Almaz officials told Space.com the company's first flight would be in 2013. I think they're going to miss that by a couple of years. Not too bad for a private venture, though. The architecture for the lunar mission involves a Soviet Almaz reusable return vehicle called an RRV, which can carry three people. Launched by a Soyuz FG rocket, this rocket also launches Russia's Soyuz manned capsule. The RRV weighs 6,600 pounds and has a habitable volume of 159 cubic feet. Yes, that's larger than a Ford Escape. The lunar flight also uses a Salyut-class 63,800-pound space station that is launched by a Proton rocket. While Excalibur Almaz intends to use the Soyuz, FG, and Proton initially, Dula did not rule out using other rockets, including Space Exploration Technologies, that's the SpaceX people, Falcon 9 in the future. Dula said Excalibur Almaz would wait for the Falcon 9 to accumulate enough flights that it became feasible to ensure the space station module aboard the rocket. Because I'm sure with that class of passenger, we're not talking about chimps here, you're going to have some whopping insurance because nobody wants the rich uncle to get on the capsule and die in space. The gravy train would come to an end, having spent $150 million of their hard-earned inheritance. Want insurance to replace that. Come on, Dad. Our customers are private expedition members, and I think it is fundamentally different to tourism, Dula said. What we are offering with the lunar flights is more like expeditions. Once in orbit, the station and RRV will dock, and the station's propulsion system, which is a group of electric Hall effect thrusters, propels the stack out to the moon. Excalibur Almaz is in talks with Natick Mass, a Massachusetts-based Busek space station, space propulsion, to develop the Hall effect thrusters needed. Dula described an electric system for the station module that would use up to 100,000 watts of power for its thrusters. If a solar or cosmic radiation event threatened a flight's crew and passengers, the company would run power through electrical lines around the station and keep most of the charged particles away by generating a magnetic field around the capsule. Protons you can keep out with an electrical field. He also said the station would have a refuge area crew and passengers could use to protect against radiation storms that weren't, you know, charged particles. I think the charged particles could easily be kept away by a magnetic field, but the higher frequency X-rays could not. So you'd have to have some kind of a lead protected area to absorb those. In addition to electric thrusters to propel a space station to the moon, Excalibur Almaz must pay for the development of digital flight control computers, life support systems, and an in-space propulsion system. Dula indicated that his company has spent about $150 million on the in-orbit space propulsion module. The cost is, say, around $250 million. We already have much of the non-recurring expense, engineering, research, and development paid for this, he said. This propulsion system is based on the European Space Agency's Automated Transfer Vehicles Propulsion Module, EADS. Astrium is a contractor for Excalibur Almaz. Another contractor is Russian military and industrial joint stock company, Mashinostroyenia. Abdullah emphasized the investment by the Soviet Union that Excalibur Almaz was able to leverage. We already have a proven emergency escape system that's operated 9 times and 1 time in an actual failure. A real test, and it worked. We have reissued all the drawings for this emergency escape system to modern standards, and they are ready to be built, and we have a cost estimate for the first 10 units. According to Excalibur Almaz, the Almaz program saw 9 unmanned RRV test flights and use of the spacecraft for ferrying equipment and cargo to the Almaz space stations. The RRVs were in orbit for up to 175 days, and while docked with the station, they were occupied to validate the life support system. While the RRVs spent time in only low Earth orbit, the heat shield is designed to cope with the greater heat experienced from a moon return trajectory. Dula said that the RRV capsules can be reused up to 15 times each, according to their Russian manufacturer. We performed technical feasibility studies of the RRV and their subsystems, as well as launch vehicle compatibility and the overall program architecture. It's kind of interesting that these things have already been up there. They've been in low orbit. They've been tested. They've had people in them. They have drawings on their website. I'm impressed. I got to tell you, if I was a billionaire with nothing better to do, I'd sign up in a second. Dula also said that his space transportation system could be used by individuals, governments, and private companies that wanted to conduct research or bring metals back from near-Earth objects, such as the billionaire-backed planetary resources firm plans to do. He added that where governments wanted to operate on the moon, Excalibur Almaz could deliver a telecommunications satellite that would serve the moon from a Lagrange point to orbit, and gave a price of $75 million. A Lagrange point is a point of equilibrium in Earth's orbit. There are 2 of them, so that the point that's equidistant between the sun and the Earth, where you're neither pulled by the sun or pulled by the Earth, you can remain in that spot indefinitely. Just minor adjustments to compensate for solar and galactic winds can be done through, you know, simple catalytic thrusters, and you can carry enough fuel to last for 20 years for something like that. So putting these communication satellites in place would give basically communications inside Earth's orbit from the moon to the Earth without any dark spots. You remember when Apollo went around the moon on the other side of the moon, it was blocked line of sight from making radio communication with the Earth while it was on the dark, the quote, far side of the moon. So with these Lagrange point transmitters, receivers, the capsule could be in 100% contact with the Earth ground control at all times. The L2 location is 930,000 miles from Earth and away from the sun as well. So it's an equilibrium point called a Lagrange point. The interesting thing is that they believe that there are other moons out there in Earth's orbit. That is to say, and they're lurking around these Lagrange points. So that's the interesting thing, that these satellites might not be alone out there. And frankly, if you were coming in from elsewhere and you wanted to just hang around the Earth and monitor what was going on, that would be an ideal place to sit. The company also plans to offer other lunar Lagrange point services, such as deep space technology testing for $150 million per mission and payload delivery to the lunar surface for $350 million. I got to tell you guys, this is a deal. This is a yard sale when it comes to NASA. If they wanted to get technology up there, all they'd have to do is contact the Excalibur Almaz guys, put those crates on board, give the deployment instructions to the crew, and throw it out the trap door. This is a yard sale for NASA. NASA can't even put the planning committee together for $150 million a mission. It's a deal. And this is where entrepreneurialism really shines. This is where we as a race are at our best. When we conquer the frontiers, whether it's ocean or mountains or deserts or space, and we do it in such a way that you know, it allows history to be made not by governments but by innovation and leadership among the private sector. And I really see in the next 20 years three areas of innovation that are really, really going to take off. They're already at their breaking point right now. One, of course, is space travel. I do see that because there's a lot of junk out there that's been thrown away by governments. They don't want to use it anymore. They could be put to perfectly good use by entrepreneurs, a la Salvage One, our good buddy Andy again. You remember that program. The other is healthcare. I've already talked about the local clinics, the doc in a box, the urgent care. That's going to be taken to the next level, and it's going to be taken into the research area. I predict that with private labs and innovative research, that not treatments, but cures for diseases are going to be forthcoming. We know enough about the genome. We know enough about enzymatic synthesis. We use it all the time in all kinds of things. We even use it in pigments. We use it in inorganic synthesis all the time. We use enzymes. We use it in the production of cellulosic alcohol. We're good at designing enzymes. We can, through the private sector, design cures for diseases. Now, whether or not that's going to make it through the FDA, you know, the almighty that has decided which drugs you can and cannot take, and I've already expressed myself tonight on, you know, commercials on television telling people, patients, you know how smart they are, to go sell the drug to their doctor. Hey, I saw this drug on TV. I definitely have these symptoms. Please prescribe me this drug. What doctor in his right mind would listen to that? None. At least with Pfizer or Libby, when you have the drug rep come in, he brings some cool stuff and he buys lunch. Or he takes up 90 seconds of your time and he talks about drug-drug interactions and he gives you a couple free samples and you hand them out to guinea pigs, I mean patients, to see how they work. You don't have patients coming in selling the doctor on the drugs. Obviously, the drug companies are buying millions and millions of dollars worth of commercial time. I want to take that drug Sally Fields takes. You get it? Well, I think the private industry is going to launch in a different direction. We have holistic remedies that are out there that take care of beta blocking, ACE inhibiting, all kinds of treatments that we now get through pharmaceutical means, you can get through natural means. Different roots, berries, flowers, different kinds of organic compounds that are synthesized out of nature. They're better for you. They're digestible. They don't have near the side effects. And guess what? They're less expensive. And you can get them through an ND, MD and an ND. So it's available. It's out there. And I'm telling you that treatments are going to give way to cures. So that's the second area. And the third area is in the area of commerce. We're already breaking out of the fixed method of moving cash back and forth. We don't trust the banks. Obviously, if you put your money in your banks, you can't get it out. We know this because we saw Jamie Dimon, what, a few weeks ago testifying before Congress. He was brilliant. He was flashy. He dwarfed the congressmen that were trying to ask him questions, but he let something slip. No, it wasn't the $2 billion of depositors' money that he lost. That's a drop in the bucket, believe me. We're not talking about John Corzine losing $2 billion of depositors' money that they weren't even gambling with. We're talking about $2 billion, not for a small financial company like MF Global. We're talking about a bank that has over $2 trillion in cash on hand deposits. Yeah, just compare $2 billion against $2 trillion. It's a lot of zeros, folks, let me tell you. The point is that nobody on the congressional committee asked Mr. Dimon, what are you doing with $2 trillion of depositors' money on hand? Why isn't that out in the community working? Why isn't it out meeting the credit needs of a manufacturing world that's completely out of cash and needs to fund purchase orders, needs to put capital equipment in place. Why isn't that money working in the very communities from which it was extracted? That question never got asked. Well, be that as it may, we know that cash does not exist out there. It's not flowing. And if, even if it does exist, they're not going to give it up, not for small business. So the innovation has got to take place in a small business arena, and this is just now breaking. In fact, this might be the first time you've ever heard it. Suppliers and manufacturers and customers are beginning to craft their own form of currency. Now, I'm not talking about money. I'm talking about value. Value trading throughout the system. We've seen a cheap copy of it in carbon credits, and we've already seen the counterfeiting going on out there and people going to jail. And the biggest counterfeiter of all is going to be the government. It's going to be hugely corrupt. But private industry can do it and make it work, and you're going to see it expand. So those are the three areas that I really see changing. It's going to decentralize the way that commerce is paid for, just like it is education. All right, in terms of Excalibur Almaz's wider business plans, this is really interesting. Dula says we've got unmanned research missions, human transportation, and tourism. We have commissioned market studies. We've never announced these before. We have a complete business plan for cargo deliveries for the International Space Station. We just haven't released it. He added that if NASA reopened bids for supplying International Space Station cargo, he would respond. For low Earth orbit missions, Dula said the RRVs and space stations could each be worth about $35 million per year in advertising revenue alone, according to the studies paid for by the Excalibur Almaz. Yeah, it's one thing to have your ad on the side of a NASCAR car doing 200 miles an hour every Sunday on national television. It's quite another to have your ad on the side of a space capsule. He also confidently said of his Futron report, there is a market for commercial, dedicated, unmanned scientific research missions. One of our capsules may well be dedicated to such missions. He priced this service at $225 million and added that a manned scientific research mission would cost $500 million. Dula is not the first to offer commercial unmanned spacecraft science missions. SpaceX is planning its Dragon Lab service, the first of which the company's website launch manifest states will occur in 2014. That's just around the corner. SpaceX's Dragon Lab fact sheet does not list any prices. For these missions, Excalibur Almaz would use a new module, which is being developed with the help of the EADS, Astrium. On its website, Excalibur Almaz described a service module which is used for storing consumables and acts as a habitation area, and a cargo module that can deliver up to 22,000 pounds of cargo. That's a lot of cheeseburgers. For crew transport to low Earth orbit, Dula said that NASA was distorting the market by paying $63 million per seat. But that, his company, is still on part of NASA's Commercial Crew Development Program with a non-funded Space Act agreement. Dula said that Excalibur Almaz had achieved all of its CCDEV milestones on time and on budget so far. Nothing even close to that can be claimed by NASA. The Isle of Man headquartered company is subject to the UK's Outer Space Treaty Law. The UK Space Agency does not have any manned spaceflight rules, but has talked about developing them because of suborbital space line Virgin Galactic. Virgin Galactic, owned by Sir Richard Branson's Virgin Group, is a UK company. Despite its US arm, Virgin Galactic LLC, which conducts the suborbital flights, Branson's firm is still expected to obtain UK launch licenses. Of one thing, Dula is certain. If you don't have an escape system, you will never get a license from the British Space Agency. Yeah, we want to have a way to get people off the ship should something go wrong. I want to do a quick recap on the expeditions. Lots of people have asked me about it. I haven't really done a recap other than the Coast to Coast AM program with George Noory last month. As you know, we have a Park Avenue production company in New York. Most of the big production companies are in New York for documentaries or in the D.C. area. Discovery Channel is down in Silver Springs, Maryland, but they don't sponsor anything like this. They're only resellers of airtime. This is truly a documentary film company, and they are on location right now filming one. As soon as that one is done and they're back in New York, they're going to be putting the deposit down on the ship. And that will be a major milestone right there. Once that deposit is in place, once that's out there, we can post that to the website and show the world that it's officially a go. We can say it's a go now, but until you write the check, is it really a go? That's what they're asking. Once the check is written and the ship is committed, then we'll start the process of going through a little over 4,000 applicants for 38 available spots. We do have 100 spaces, maybe 102 or 103 if some of the ship's research crew is left behind. We're still trying to decide whether or not we're going to take them with us since they know these waters better than anyone. They know the marine life better than anyone. We may bring them. But we do have Jill Heinerth, who is an under-ice diver, and her team. She's done more than 50 excursions for National Geographic. She's a seasoned veteran, one of the most skilled under-ice diver photographers in the world. She's done deep-water caves and all kinds of stuff, and she really brings a lot to the table. We also have Harvard, MIT, Stanford University, and Washington universities that have issued papers. We're going to be granting them money, a passage for a grad student team with their agenda to gather information, provided that the act of gathering the information can be filmed. I'm not sure that the nature of their data collection or their experiments would be of interest to the viewing public. But the fact that they're out there for 15 days in high seas and high winds and breaking ice with the rest of us is interesting to the rest of you. And if they do validate something strange or anomalous that we find, that would be interesting as well. So we're petitioning them, and we're going to be granting them a passage, which is definitely value added, somewhere around $90,000 per school. So it's a fair amount of outgo from Phoenix Science Foundation for that. The other aspect is that we are putting together a tech team to have two separate satellite uplinks, redundancy, and we'll be downloading those to two separate servers on two separate continents at undisclosed locations so that tens of thousands of you, maybe millions of you, can log on and watch what's going on the ship. We'll have a video upfeed. It'll be low resolution enough that you can watch it from your computer, high resolution enough so that, you know, it's almost public TV quality. But the point is that we only have 100 spaces, and we need to take 40 million people with us. So that also creates a revenue stream that's very needed for the expedition. Obviously, each one of you signing on, it's going to cost you $2 or $3, something like that. Not much, because we want a lot of people to watch. It's got to be, you know, less than the cost of a movie. And once you sign up, you'll be good for the whole 15 days. So if we can get 10 or 20 million people to sign up to watch that, well, you can obviously see that the production company can recoup their expenses and make enough money to do the post-production work. And that's what really needs to be done. Plus, if we're successful, and I'm sure that we will be, if we get close to the goal of finding this mythical opening into the inner Earth, we're certainly not intending on taking a 450-foot-long, 23,000-ton, 75,000-horsepower nuclear-powered vessel inside the planet. That ain't going to happen. But there's another boat on the ship, and there's a helicopter on the ship, so we can explore. And we can also set ourselves up for another venture. Once you have an ice-rated vessel with you to break the ice, you can take another vessel behind it with another intention, shall we say. And then you can do some other exploring on a future mission. but you got to make money on the first one, and you got to make it happen so that that second mission and third mission and maybe third, fourth, fifth, sixth mission can be done. John brought up an interesting point tonight in that the very act of doing the expedition has, for maybe reasons inexplicable, created a feeling of mutual hope for everyone. I don't know why that is. I mean, maybe anciently in the scriptures it talks about the lost 10 tribes disappearing inside the earth. It talks about latter day highway of ice being formed and races returning out of the inner earth. It's all kinds of legends from all over the world about this. But the act of actually physically doing this expedition, not flying over it, not taking satellite photos, but actually taking a boat and going somewhere where no one has ever sailed before, just brings people together in a way that I just can't explain. I never expected to see it, but it's undeniable. It is happening. And so we want to serve that faction of society. We want to be able to reach those people. We want to be able to provide them with an experience that fortifies that feeling without, you know, being artistic with it. Just the act of going is not unlike, you know, watching Deadliest Catch, except that, you know, Deadliest Catch is risking man against the waves to see how fast you can fill up the hold full of snow crabs, so that, you know, the crew could make themselves wealthy for a summer. And believe it or not, for several years, that was Discovery Channel's number one program. Now, of course, it's gone to a much higher echelon. It's a much higher level of television. It's Pawn Stars. Yeah, it's, you know, yeah, Pawn Stars. That's the number one program out there on Discovery Channel. Our History Channel as well. So I don't know where that's going. I can tell you that the public is very excited about this expedition. And I'm excited about it. It gets me up. Every week we do something on it. We have for more than 6 years. Our board has worked for a long, long time on this, and several of them longer than me. And some people have even raised the money and given the money to the, when Stephen Curry was the runner, the operator of the expedition. And I think that's wonderful, but this is not a tourist trip. What we're talking about here is something much, much broader and much more aggressive, and we're going into the hole here. We're going into a place that no one has ever gone before, and maybe, just maybe, we will see something no one else has seen before. Maybe we'll see more than whales and ice. Maybe we'll see this mythical opening. And if there is advanced life on the inside, maybe they will come out to see us. And that's basically what it boils down to. So I don't know. I have hope, just like you all do. I'm excited about it. It's a risk, to be sure. It's not going to be a pleasure cruise, 120-foot seas, 70-mile-an-hour winds, sub-freezing temperatures, 15 days at sea with 100 people I've never met and 150 crew members that may or may not speak a tremendous amount of English on a ship that's a former Soviet. I think it's going to be an adventure, to be sure. There will be injuries, yes. But I think that it'll be value added for the world of exploration. And I really, really appreciate you being supportive of it over the years. And it's the only thing that's allowed me to take the flack professionally for being involved with it. And I appreciate it. And I thank you very much for that. Well, it's we got about 10 minutes still, so we got to wrap it up. I'm out of time. We'll be back next week. Don't forget, Neil Kramer coming on the 29th. Pick up his book, Unfoldment. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or everywhere fine books are sold. And get yourself ready. It is an excellent read. Neil is a fabulous writer, and I know you're going to enjoy it. Lots of good sections in there on everything from crop circles to human psyche, and you're just going to enjoy it. Let's play a little something out of the past as we disappear into the sweltering night sky. Hopefully it cools off a little bit tomorrow when we get some relief from Mother Nature. Peace and joy, my friends, and remember, you are Source.